tell you, in friendship, before we start. Normally I would make a coffee before we start recording the podcast, right?
Yeah.
And I did not have time today. So the only solution that I had very quickly was I stopped to McDonald's on the way to the studio. And while I was there, I was like, you know what? I'm going to treat myself to an Egg McMuffin, whatever the thing is, Egg Biscuit, whatever the thing is.
Yeah.
And Brad, my stomach is angry with me. It is angry with me during this podcast.
You can't keep up with the arches anymore, can you?
Brad, I don't know that any human should.
Oh,
it's not.
No.
It's not food.
I used to. Well, here's kind of part of which has me sad about the world we live in. I used to work in McDonald's when I was in high school, and back then we used to actually make the burgers on a grill. You know, and I was really good at it. I got to a point where I could flip 2 and 3 patties at a time. If a bus came in, man, they threw me back on the grill because I could just turn and burn those suckers. And when you look, do you ever spend any time looking at them making your food in the back of McDonald's? They've got all those plastic shelves that they're pulling out, the little trays. It doesn't even look like real food.
Well, and everything now, because they are hyper efficient as a corporation, which kudos to them, but like every button that they press is already pre-measured. Like the ice dispensary is pre-measured, and then you press medium and that's pre-measured. And it's fascinating in the fact and how factory it is, but it's not food. Like my stomach is having some trubs over here.
No. Well, yeah. And that's the other thing. I used to, you know, when you'd worked at McDonald's, you'd work, you know, 3 or 4 days a week. And if you worked longer than, I think it was 6 hours or 8 hours, I forget which, but if you worked a full shift, you got a break in the middle. And then you got free food. And then if you worked at like a half of a shift, you got a break at the end and you'd get free food. So I was eating, you know, how many, 4 or 5 quarter pounders with cheese per week, you know, and have no effect on me whatsoever. In fact, you know, I walked around rail thin because my metabolism was incredible at that point in my life, but had no adverse effects whatsoever. I have no doubt in my mind that today, if I had more than 1 quarter pounder with cheese in the span of 7 days, I'd be laid out, unable to get out of bed.
Yeah, I feel like a good chunk of my morning is going to be devoted to worrying about that egg and biscuit thing that I ate from McDonald's. There's going to be some troubles right after this podcast is finished.
Now, it was probably too early. So you weren't able to get French fries, were you?
No, I did not.
Because you know what the big news about McDonald's French fries is.
Wait, are you? This is a joke. What are you leading into?
I'm not making this up, Ed. Have you heard about this? There's a chemical in McDonald's French fries that cures baldness, according to some researcher. That's Johnny Carson, by the way.
Yes, I know, and I'm holding your hand through this process. We will get through this impersonation together. No, I thought that was delightful. What is the big news about McDonald's fries?
They've identified a chemical, and it's found in McDonald's French fries that researchers think might help cure baldness.
What?
Yeah.
In French?
You look it up. Look it up. It's trending on a bunch of the social media sites. And I think it's a Chinese research facility, but they've discovered this. They think that they can use this chemical to help cure baldness. And it just so happens the chemical is in McDonald's French fries.
Now, is this a genetic tie-in that is basically the same Neanderthal DNA that says, hey, McDonald's is a good idea for me to eat right now, is also the same thing that...
Yeah, well, I don't know that eating, I don't know that ingesting it would help. Maybe I'm going to try rubbing them on my head and see if...
Frankly, it is probably better for your health to rub a McDonald's French fry on your head.
Just lie down and avoid them. Part of me hopes that it works, and part of me is afraid I'll have to start shampooing with ketchup.
Well, on that note, hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Sheldon and Drive and co-director of Stripped.
And then this week's hour of comics advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. Dave, how you doing?
I am doing well, except for my stomach. No, I'm doing good. The move is going good. We did the first open houses this weekend, and it's weird. I should share this with everybody else because the LA market is strange. They made a video, Brad, of my house. Brad.
I think you were showing this to me.
Yes, I was showing you the video. I got to share this with people, though. Yeah. So in LA, I guess they do this in New York and other San Francisco and other big markets, too. But they don't just say, oh, here's some real estate photos of the house. They make a video of the house. And you may be thinking, okay, so a cinematographer or a photographer came through with a camera and shot some 2K stuff and edited it together. No, they hired actors, Brad.
Oh my God.
Brad, they hired strange people to walk around my house and be attractive and weird.
I have so many questions. Having seen this video, I have so many questions. My wife and I watched it and she has questions. We've got a list of questions.
Brad, if the first question is, did these actors have sex on my couch? I don't know. That is the big... I was not here when they did this, and I'm fairly sure that might have happened.
Oh,
I am not
God.
Sure.
There's so much fascinating stuff that goes into not only selecting these actors, but deciding what they're going to do as they're moving through the house. There's a beautiful point, and we really should post this so people can see it.
No, I'm not posting my real estate video.
At one point, they try to. It's we should say on the outset, it's two. It's a white man and white woman. And at one point, they're in your studio and they're playing on your billiards table. And he makes a shot or she makes a shot, and then they try to high five each other. And it's one of those unbelievably typically awkward high fives that kind of
yes.
miss. And then in the last scene, he's in your backyard pretending to put up the swing set that you've got back there. And I looked at my wife and I said, if they screw the way they high five, they're going to be childless for a long time.
The high five was awkward. The whole thing was awkward. It's just weird. It's a weird thing. But, LA is such a visual market and actors are so cheap. Actors are dime a dozen, so it's like, all right, we just need two fairly normal-looking people that can act and do this thing, and people come out and do it. I guess it's weird. It's weird. The whole thing is weird.
Wow.
It's very strange.
Is this somebody's career path? In other words, do these people get called back on house after house after house? It's like, oh, yeah, get her. She's really good at, making a living room look habitable, when she walks into it. Are there actors that hang their hats on their ability to deliver great real estate footage?
Oh my God, that's amazing. Also, think about this from the actor's perspective. I got the call back for the Brownstone, Brad.
Yeah, the Brownstone, Brad. Is that going to be on NBC?
Nope, it's going to be on Zillow.
and again, now it's a white man and a white woman. So do they have to? Is there any benefit for reshooting this with a black man and a black woman or an Asian man? And what about two Asian women or two Latinx men?
No, it raises a whole host of questions because a part of my wife was like, wait a minute, why did I get recast as a white woman?
Yeah.
Like for me, you'll laugh at this. My reaction was, hey, why'd they cast an old guy as me? And then I kind of took a look in the mirror and I was like, oh crap, I guess that is kind of my age now, isn't it? Shoot.
I would imagine they have to choose these people careful because I noticed that they were in that zone where they were attractive but not overly attractive. They weren't like stunning beauties, but they weren't ugly either. They were like right there in the middle where you could believe that that's you, but it's maybe a little bit shined up version of you.
Maybe. Although it might also be that like, come on, Brad, it's real estate video. You're not going to get the true attractives.
Yeah.
Those people are across town at NBC. They're not going out for a Zillow part number three,
Wow. And I got to wonder if it pays well.
I can't imagine that it does. I mean, they awkwardly high-fived. How much can that pay?
Oh, it just, I watched that through a couple times. Between the music and the acting, it was just, it was gorgeous in its strangeness.
Now, I have to say, though, the music and the way they cut it together, that was good, actually. I have to say, as like production quality in LA, I was like, oh, actually, that's pretty good. It was really just the weirdness of these two actors who clearly don't know each other, but they're kind of going through the motions as though they know each other. And it's just weird. It was weird.
Well, yeah, they were acting as if they knew each other.
And even just like, well, let's turn to comic matters.
Let's start out with this one, because I've been wanting to talk about this for a long time, Dave. And here's the setup. You wrote a great comic. Now cut 30% from the dialogue and make it great. In other words, it's kind of related to the Garfield rule of scripting. So let's talk about one of the unsung talents, one of the unsung skills in cartooning, and that is editing.
It is incredibly important. And in fact, the older I get, the more I realize how much it is central to the process and how much, frankly, I failed in the first like decade of my cartooning to self-edit well. And we should probably start off by saying, like, it is admittedly one of the hardest things you have to do is to edit your own work. But it is a talent that you have to cultivate if you're going to get better at this. And I like that idea of 30% as just a baseline to start with.
You had written that down, the Garfield rule of scripting. Is that an actual rule that I'm unfamiliar with? Or is that just like you're saying Garfield's always really short, so we'll call it the Garfield?
No, so I wanted to, we can call it the Garfield rule. I want to talk about this. And so when we interviewed Jim Davis for Strip, he very specifically called out the fact that no Garfield strip, and I'm going to get this number wrong, but somebody can count and get the number right. No Garfield strip contains more than 25 words. Mm. And I said, that can't be right, Jim. No Garfield strip contains more than 25 words? And he's like, yeah. He has set that as a very specific rule. In the same way that Google on their homepage for a long time said no more than like 10 words of text on their homepage. Remember when they had that rule?
Yeah.
And the idea is that, I mean, Garfield is admittedly written for children, right? I mean, it's like, granted, there's a lot of secretaries that love it, but it's written for kids. And so there is an extreme power in a heavily visual, less verbose strip in Garfield's world. But there's a lesson to be learned there, which is that if you set perhaps an artificial limit to how much text you can put into a comic strip or a comic page, there might be some value to that. And so I like that idea that Davis has created for himself. And I think a version of that could be applied to everyone's work. Not that extreme, but a version of that.
Well, and okay, so take a look at what happened when Twitter came on the scene and there was the 140 character limit and everyone was like, I'm not going to do that. I can't hardly fit into a 140 character limit. And then you'd start writing out these tweets and you'd get to the limit and then you'd have to go back and reword it. And what I found in doing this is that 9 chances out of 10, that tweet that I came up with that fit the 140 character rule was a much better written message than the one that I had set out to write.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right.
When Twitter came out with the idea of expanding to, what was it, 280, the fascinating thing was there was a pushback. People didn't like that idea.
Yeah, and so much of that too is, and this also can go into our comics, is not from a writer's perspective where people complaining, but from a reader's perspective, because you could essentially consume more ideas when it was at 140 than when everything was doubled to 280. Yeah. You know, you could basically get 50% of the ideas for, double the reading. There's something to be learned there from a comic strip perspective is that you get to the punch faster, you get a more satisfying journey because people don't feel like it's a wasted effort if they've gone through a page or a comic strip that's heavy on text. Mm-hmm. And there is a style of joke that requires a heavy text. We should probably say that.
Well, yeah, like the classic Shaggy Dog story where the whole point is keeping your reader on the hook for as long as possible and then not delivering a punchline.
Right. That as a daily exercise is going to scare away an audience faster than anything. For me, the way that I have started to do it most effectively is to use time as an editor. And we talked about this a few weeks back. But the idea that you write a strip and then you let it sit fallow in whatever format you've stored it, in either in your notebook, your email inbox, or whatever you want. And then you come back to it with fresh eyes and you go, oh, I see what I was getting at, but there's one word could replace this entire sentence.
Yep.
And then you start swapping out and trimming down. And it's a much more effective joke or script by the time you're done.
Well, and let's talk specifically just for a second about humor. Really, if delivering a funny comic strip or delivering a funny line is all about editing. I review a lot of comics for webcomics.com, and a lot of them are humor comics. And time again, I'm telling these creators, you've got to understand what a gag is, what a joke is. And what it is this. It's all about tension and release. In a typical four-panel comic, you build up tension for three panels. Build, build, build. By the fourth panel, you relieve that tension. You pop the balloon. And that's what a joke is. You build, and then you pop. And in setting up that joke, you've got to know what your joke is. You got to know what the punchline is. Anything that doesn't lead in a certain path, that doesn't build to a specific place, has to be removed.
Yep. No, that's true. Yeah, remove any cruft, remove anything that doesn't add to the process. Absolutely. Yeah. So how do you sit down with Evil Ink, for example, with the page?
I'll start with a blank page and I'll mentally divide it into like four or five columns. And I'll start writing in a very skinny column down. And then I will branch out at different points from there to find where the funny is or find where the best funny is. And so that's why it's helpful to write in a column, because my first panel might be very good, or the first two panels might be very good. And I don't want to keep rewriting those sentences over and over again. So by the time I get done charting out a joke, it looks kind of like a tree, because there's all these branches that branch out from the center trunk, or maybe there's a trunk that started and kind of didn't go anywhere, and the whole thing kind of grows off of a second branch. And I don't know whether you're visualizing what I'm saying, but you can probably agree with me if you say that 9 chances out of 10, most of the strips that you've written, you wrote maybe a 6-panel strip and then went back and just started from panel 3, because you really didn't need the first two panels.
That's very true. Yeah, absolutely. I'm fascinated by this idea, Brad, of the branching tree. I've never thought to do it like that. So I want to make sure I have this right. So you have a blank piece of paper ahead mm-hmm. of you, in front of you. You start writing panel 1 at the top left of the page or the top center of the page?
Usually I'll go like, if you divide your page into columns, I'll kind of start in column 2. So there's a little bit of room to the left if I need it, you know, to write any notes. But I pretty much start on the left side of the page, leaving a little bit of space, and then I'll start writing straight down. And no pictures at this point, just words. So I'm just writing inside that mental column on the page. And then, you know, sometimes I luck out and I write and it just goes straight down, boom, 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 boom. I did that last week. It was just something for the comic that went in today's update. As a matter of fact, everything just fit nice and neat. And sometimes, you know, you start and it's like, it didn't go anywhere. Where can I branch out? And then it's basically like retracing your steps and saying, okay, what if something different had been said in this moment? Where can they go from there? And then it just keeps branching off from that. And a lot of times what you find out, it's all about that first panel. A lot of times you don't need the first panel at all and you end up cutting it. Or the whole concept put forth by the first panel fell apart and you need to start at a new first panel.
This idea of branching off is fascinating to me. I've been writing comics for 20 whatever years now and I've never thought to do it this
well,
way.
Well, if you pick up the Webcomics Handbook, I do a section where I scanned in one of my pages from my sketchbook where I was writing, and I called it cascading brainstorming, because it's kind of the same idea. You just cascade down the page, although think thinking about it as a tree is a much better visual. But yeah, it's something that I talked about in that book where I said, you know, you just keep going down. And so I will, almost like a mental patient, start from the top and write down. And then if I don't find the funny, I start again from the top. And I may not rewrite that first opening, but then I'll go down again and branch off somewhere and see if the funny is there and see, you know, at some point something happens where, you know, it, and if you're, you know, I got a feeling you're probably similar to me in that you're always listening for the funny. So of a sudden, well, you get to that point and you can smell it. You know, something's here. I know I can do something with this, even when you don't know that it's going to happen yet. That's, you know, you were talking about those 5 minutes you want to bottle up in your creative process. That's another 5 minute for me is when I know that it's there and I don't know what it is yet, but I know that it's there.
Yeah. You have the scent of it. Yeah.
And it's like, it's here. It's right here somewhere. All I need is the right word that I can play off of, the right, you know, if it's a double entendre or if it's a word that I can use to purposefully misdirect my audience and make them think I'm going to the left and then I go to the right. That's the heart of funny. Is misdirection. Make them think you're going to the left and then go to the right.
Right, you know? Right, absolutely. The way that I do it is, in my mind, I guess if I had to categorize it, I change the accepted reality of the early dialogue in order to get to a different punchline when I'm trying to edit. Mm. And what I mean by that is you and I, just conversationally right now, have accepted, our shared accepted reality is that we are talking about a decision tree, right, or we're talking about a cascade, right? But what if instead of saying tree or cascade 5 minutes ago, Brad had said a waterfall? It's like water hitting different rocks and falling in different directions down the waterfall, yeah, right? And so then our conversation for the last 10 minutes, our accepted reality would have been about waterfalls. And so what I do when I'm editing is I go back and I say, if I still want to get to this point, but I want to do it more efficiently, what different accepted realities, different conversational flows could they have taken to get to that same point, but get there faster or get there in a
really good. Yeah.
So it's the same. It's the idea that, like, if two of my characters are talking, it's basically the idea that it's a choice that led to four other choices dialogue. But if you go back and change an early choice, whatever conversational reality they had started with, whatever premise they had started with, because very often the premise that you put forward is in that first panel or first pages are, you're basically laying down what the accepted reality of that moment is. Are they upset about shoes or Velcro? Are they upset about whatever they're upset about? There's an accepted reality towards what you're writing, right? Mm-hmm. Like the reader's willing to go along with it. So allow yourself to cheat that accepted reality with either a stronger position or a slightly modified position that gets you to your punchline or gets you to your point of action in your page faster.
Yeah.
That's one of the techniques that I use to get my editing stronger is that I go back and change the fundamental premise, the conversational premise that they started with to get to the same point. And what's interesting is that's metaphorically, that's just a different version of what you do with the decision tree or the conversational tree that you have set up in your right mind, although it's a better visual what you have.
Well, and something that you said brought another facet of editing to mind. Again, knowing the mechanics of building humor. And really, all I mean, we're gonna get people saying, "How come you always talk about humor? You never talk about anything else." Well, that's kind of where our wheelhouse is. But you can easily extrapolate this to apply to a broader style of writing in terms of a punchline specifically. Know what you're building. Know the mechanics of a joke, and that is this. And I see you see this happen a lot with beginning writers, and that is they'll have a setup, they'll set up, boom, 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 they'll hit the punchline, and then some other character will say, "Yeah," or they'll say, "That's right," or they'll say anything, and it's the worst construction ever. And because here's the deal. You have to understand, when you're building a joke, everything builds to that balloon popping. When that balloon is popped, you've released all the tension. Anything that happens after that had better lead to another joke. And it is possible to have a little bumper at the end, to put a little stinger on it. That's possible.
Right.
But if if you've hit your punchline, and I am sorry, I punched my microphone. If you've hit your punchline and then you start another setup, you're building tension again. If you don't successfully relieve that tension, you're leaving your readers tense. You haven't hit another joke. You haven't popped the second balloon. Anything that happens after the punchline had better be fucking funny, or it had better be edited out.
Wow, that's interesting. So my immediate reaction to that was that I could see moments where, if it's character-based, where some reaction can bring, if not humor, can add to the character, but I can already anticipate that you'll be like, I don't care. That's not, no.
Well, on the, we've been friends for a long time, and you guessed it exactly right. No, I think if you're going to do that, it had better be really, really important character development. Or, you know, if you're going to let that sit there, do it for a really good reason.
I see why you're saying this broadly. And I think, I don't know why I'm finding that I want to take exception to this, because it's not like it's critical to me. But I feel like there's probably a 5 or 10% rule where there's exceptions to that rule. Because normally I would agree with you that it's best to end on the blow.
Yeah.
But I feel like there are character moments where their idiocy or their inability to see the blow, I guess is one way of saying it, mm-hmm. or to react appropriately to the blow is a secondary bit of icing on the cake that you could have coming after the punch. And so I don't know why I'm finding this as a fight that I don't really care. I don't know why I'm fighting you on this.
Let me give you an audio example of what I'm talking about. Jay Leno started out as one of the most fantastic stand-up comedians. If you listen to stand-ups talking about comedy and they talk about some of the greats, they're always going to list people like Pryor and George Carlin and Chris Rock, the craftspeople of the trade. But Jay Leno gets listed up there as people that that comedians really appreciate. When he got near the end of his Tonight Show run, he became known for kind of a style of delivery that wasn't as great as when he started, and that was he would tell a joke and then he would kind of like chatter. You know what I'm talking about? He'd go, did you guys hear about this? And they got this thing called the McDonald's French fries, right? And the good news is it brings you to your hair. The bad news is you have to shampoo with ketchup. You've heard about ketchup, haven't you? A little tomato on your head? You got some tomatoes right there on your head. Huh? Isn't that something? Hey, let's talk about something else. And then he goes on to the next thing. But if you're being honest with yourself, you just want him to hit that punchline and shut up and hold for the laugh.
I got to tell you, I want to be honest about two things. I want him to hold for that punch and so that you can get the laugh. And I also want you to do your Jay Leno impersonation all the time. I'm not kidding when I said I very much enjoyed that. Not because it, and I want you to know, I say this with love in my heart, not because it was good, but because it was enjoyable. That was delightful. That was a really fun day.
Well, you stick around late long enough, I'll be doing accents later. So
I gotta tell you, this show, you've done two voices already and I'm loving it. I am not fighting this. I am a friend who wants to hear you do voices, so this is great. I don't want you to feel attacked in this moment. I want you to feel the warmth embrace of love that's coming from Los Angeles to Philadelphia right now, because I think that was delightful.
Well, it was my best attempt. But last thoughts on editing, because we're at the halfway mark. And do you have anything that you'd like to add? Because I have one more button I want to put on this.
Yes, by all means, put a button on it.
So
yes.
Practical editing. We've talked about editing for content and particularly editing for humor, but just a real quick word, because speaking as the person that has probably made more spelling errors than any 10 web cartoonists that you could group up and quantify, editing for stuff like grammar and spelling and punctuation is really important. So my first point is don't disregard stuff like good grammar, good punctuation. Your job as a cartoonist is to communicate. And again, if you're doing humor, you have to be very, very careful about how you're communicating, because you're kind of building a spell, and you can blow it if the person isn't reading that sentence correctly. So taking time to understand the proper use of a comma, the best time to use an em dash, a long dash, or a ellipsis, knowing proper grammar and English rules is phenomenally important to a written comedy. But also, just a quick tip, if you're like me and your spelling is atrocious, obviously getting somebody else to read this stuff before it goes live is great. Also, here's a nice little tip that if you don't have somebody you can count on for this, read your comic upside down or read it in the mirror. Do anything you can to break up that easy reading experience that you've been developing since you were 5 years old, right? Forcing your brain to process those letters into words and those words into sentences differently than it usually does, you'll be amazed at how those spelling errors and those grammar errors jump right out at you, because you're not just glossing through it. You're working for it again. So look at it in the mirror, read it upside down, get your brain to process those words differently, and you'll catch a lot more of your errors.
Well, and you know what? I know I said that I didn't have anything, but actually you talking gave me not one, but three thoughts that I want to add before we put a button on editing. So I'm sorry about this. Another thing in the editing process, and this goes back to Brad's idea of practical editing. In the editing process, one of the best things you can do, because most likely you wrote this in quiet, you're sitting in a quiet studio or space or hallway or room, and you're drawing quietly. The thing that I would recommend to you that we didn't say, and it's almost commonplace to, so maybe we didn't say it because it's so commonplace, but read it out loud.
Yes.
Give it a voice, because you will see where it doesn't sound like natural flowing language by reading it out loud, and you'll see where there are natural cuts. And by reading it out loud, you'll find that the performative aspect of your brain kicks in, and you might find alternate choices for word choices, both for your diction, for the way the sentence is structured, and for the delivery style. So reading it out loud basically changes the game for how that script is going to work.
That's a great point.
And then the second one that I would say in terms of editing is, we all get mad when people point out our typos or our grammatical errors. But here is the thing. The grammar and spelling and sentence structure are the rules on the back of every board game you've ever played. And
yeah.
So you can get mad at it, but you gotta just do it. And the way to not get those emails that bother you is to do it right, like Brad said, before you send it out into the world. So is it annoying? Absolutely. Does it make you want to punch the people that are pedantic about it? Absolutely. But language has rules, and it's best to just apply them so that you don't get grieving emails from folks.
Oh, I think we can agree on that. I mean, first of all, don't be that guy or don't be that woman that says, oh, that's how my character talks. You know, nobody believes that in the first place. You can hide behind it, but nobody's buying it. Don't be that person that says, oh, that's just, I'm using colloquialisms, that's how my character talks. It's important to get this stuff right if you want to communicate clearly. And you know, as I believe me, nobody hates to get notified about a misspelling more than I do. But in the same moment, I love the fact that they're pointing it out, because it's so much easier to change pixels than it is to erase ink. You know, I want to catch this stuff now instead of see it in a book that's already been printed.
That's, yeah, absolutely. Oh, God, definitely by the book. Oh, my God, fix it by the book. That's my one bit of advice, because once it's in print, you will hate yourself for a decade. So definitely fix it by the book. And then the third bit of advice that came up when you were talking is word choice and complexity of word choice.
Yeah.
And this is stylistic, and this can have moods and tones. So take it with a bit of grain of salt. But know that every time you up the grade reading level of your word choice, that you lose a percentage of your audience, not your entire audience. So if you really want to use the word orthogonal in a strip, you can, but just know that there are 20% of people out there that are going to have to go look up orthogonal, or they're going to skip it, not really understanding your point.
Yep.
So if you can find a word choice that lowers the grade reading level, and most newspapers and magazines are written between the fourth and seventh or eighth grade level. Mm-hmm. If you can lower it down to that reading level, because, and I say this with love, Americans are dumb. We were not educated well. No, I'm just kidding. But you can do it. And it's absolutely a stylistic choice. You can say, no, I'm cultivating a more bourgeois audience, a better educated audience. Fantastic. Good for you. Bully for you. You're very intelligent. But know that if you want to reach a broader audience, a simpler word choice or a parallel word choice that's at a lower grade reading level is oftentimes the better choice.
Isn't it possible? I think Microsoft Word does this. Isn't it possible that to write something in Word and then to get an analysis of the reading level that you're writing to?
Oh, I think maybe
I'm 98% sure that that's accurate, because I know I've done it for books that I was writing on, and at one point I was considering doing a children's book, and that was one of the tools I was using, was just write it in Word, and then it will tell you actually an awful lot of stuff about, like,
does it give you parallel word choices? Like, if you use this word, it's a 10th grade reading level.
I don't remember that happening off the top of my head, but I do remember that it would kind of say this is written to a 5th grade level or a 6th grade level. I do remember that happening.
That is very cool. But as a side note, doesn't that just seem like engineer feature bloat, like in terms of software? Like, who in the Microsoft office was like, you know what we need? We need a feature that says, like, what would it sound like if a British person read this? What would it sound like if an Australian read this? What would it sound like if a kid read this? Like, why are you adding this into Microsoft Word? Grade reading levels. But I have to say, though, that is a cool feature. But that absolutely sounds like feature bloat to me.
There was it actually goes deeper than that. There's, if you start writing stuff, particularly for children, there's a number of different writing guides that kind of say, well, this is for, like, early readers, this is for mid readers, and there's three or four that I'm familiar with just off the top of my head when I was thinking about doing this project. And you can go through and put your text into, like, an online editor, and it'll say, okay, on the McCormick-Schmick rating index, this is about a 3, and that's good for 4th graders and 5th graders. And on the, you know, Otto Panubo rating scale, this is a red, and you're looking. There's a whole bunch of different scales that you can measure your writing on, particularly if you're writing for young audiences that might not have the vocabulary you're talking about. And to the exact point that you're making, these might be kind of interesting to use. I'll see if I can, for our Patreon backers, I'll see if I can, because I know I've got all this stuff written down somewhere. I'll see if I can link to a few of these to see if maybe they're useful to people.
That's fascinating. I mean, for those that write at a very low grade level, one of the most fascinating conversations I ever had was with Mo Willems, who does the pigeon books and the elephant and piggy books and all those. Mo, by the way, is a great human being, but he was talking about how I think it was when he started doing Elephant and Piggy, he and his editors sat down and created a word list that was all he could pick from. You know, I want to say it was like 150 words, 200 words, mm-hmm. something like that. And there's no contractions. If you look at Elephant and Piggy, there's no contractions. There's a lot of no's, basically. And he says now he writes it almost intuitively, like he knows that word list by the back of his hand. Yeah. And but it's interesting that when he sat down with them, they basically banged out, like, at the most extreme level of writing from kindergarten to second grade, that this is the word list that you're going to use, you know.
Wow.
That kind of thing.
That, well, isn't that how Dr. Seuss wrote one of his books? Was they in a very similar way?
Like, it's almost like a writing challenge. Yeah. Like, you limit your word choices, and then that's all you can use.
Man, this is almost a theme, you know, that good editing comes from working within certain limits. You know, the Twitter characters and this, there's a theme of limits here, isn't there?
God, there really is. You, I think, many years ago, I think it was you, gave me the metaphor that limits on writing are kind of like it's kind of like all your ideas are held within a balloon, and you're popping a water balloon, and you're popping a very small hole in that water balloon, and so you get a very powerful stream of pressure at it. Whereas if you just broke the water balloon, you just have a wet mess, you know. I think this wasn't this a metaphor you came up with? Maybe it's not. It's kind of falling apart.
It's right way here. Too smart sounding to be something I came up with.
But I like that idea that basically limits give you focus. Limits give you basic an increased energy in whatever direction those limits point you towards. Yeah. And I like that idea.
Well, and it's also, as a web cartoonist, this the first thing that you do is say, I don't want no limits. I'm, you know, the whole idea is I'm free. I don't have editors. I don't have publishers. I don't want limits. And some self-imposed limitations might just be the first step towards improving your writing.
Yeah. Well, and this goes back to a larger conversation we used to have at Webcomics Weekly, which is, you know, Scott McCloud, to his great credit, said, hey, the internet will allow for limitless, infinite comics in every direction, scrolling upwards, downwards, backwards, scrolling forwards in 3D space, you know, all sorts of stuff. And what ended up happening, much to newspaper cartoonists and print cartoonists' chagrin, is the comic strip basically got repurposed for the web, and the comic page basically got repurposed for the web, and the graphic novel basically got repurposed for the web. And I think one of the reasons that happened is because those limitations, those very fixed set of rules for a comic strip, a comic page, and a graphic novel, they work really well for a human brain to process them at small, medium, and large chunks. And so, that once that limit set was sort of figured out, it's like, why reinvent the wheel? We just want to do it digitally.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. It's there because it works.
Well, I've just added a 10-minute button onto your button. That's called editing right there.
before we button this up anymore, we've got our first question from a Patreon backer.
Now, Brad, can you explain to everyone how that works as a process, the Patreon backer process?
I'd love to explain that, how that works.
Can you do it in a Jay Leno voice is all I want to know.
And I have a Tonight Show theme going, because the first one I did was Johnny Carson, and then I didn't even realize I had done that.
And I want you to know, because I don't want you to feel attacked. This is genuine. I really enjoyed that Jay Leno voice.
Well, see, here's the thing. At Comic Lab, you've heard of Comic Lab, right?
That's amazing. It's amazing. You
know, we've got, because we want to reward people that are kind enough to support us here at Comic Lab. So we wanted to come up with some rewards that would be useful. And so at the $5 a month level, you can submit a written question for possible use in the show. And we've got a bunch of $5 backers. You also get all those exclusive all those exclusive pro tip episodes that we've been doing. But at the $5 level, you can submit a question. At the $10 level, you can submit an audio question. And I just sent out the notifications for that. So we're going to have some audio questions. People are going to be asking the questions in their own voice on the show. And then for the $50 level, you can become a sponsor of the show. And we will read a little advertisement for you, a little promotion for your comic if you're a creator yourself. So I'm really excited that we've already got some really good questions lined up here.
And this is exciting. All right, so let's tackle this first one. Who's it from, and what's their question?
So K.R. Hinton writes that he says, I'm hoping to get to the point financially where I can delegate some of the parts of my workflow that I'm not good at and very slow on. So I wondered if you could talk about working with an assistant or a subcontractor, a colorist, a flatter, an inker. What does that contract look like? Would it be work for hire? How do you ensure that they can do the style you need? In other words, basically, he wants us to talk about working with a collaborator or an assistant. And particularly from like a contractual point of view, but also how do you just work that out? How do you get that started? And Dave, I want to start with you because I know you've got experience that I don't have, in that you've hired assistants in the past, it's somebody that just comes in and kind of like is a catch-all kind of individual, right?
Yes. So in my case right now, my assistant Beth is kind of a Jane of all trades. She is a super talented artist in her own right. I think I first met her at Emerald City Comic Con many moons ago. And as happens at a lot of Comic Cons, I got to see her art. You know, people bring come up to show different styles of art and say, "Hey, what do you think of this?" Or sometimes it's fan art that then goes, "Well, I'd like to see the rest of your stuff." You know, after that. Mm-hmm. In the intervening years, I had hired other artists, other assistants, and then about a year ago, when my most recent assistant went back to graduate school, I said, well, to Beth, she was living in Seattle at the time, on a for-hire basis, I think it was just a simple one-page contract to color Sheldon. And for those that don't know, I'm colorblind, so Sheldon's sometimes looked like... It sometimes looks like Daddy's dropped LSD. It's because Daddy can't see colors very good. So on that note, but Beth has a great eye for color and was coloring Sheldon. And then the timeline worked out where I was like, hey, would you ever want to be full-time assistant? And it worked out well for her schedule. So brought her on as a full-time employee. But those are two very different scenarios. One is a for-hire situation, which again was a simple one-page contract that I'm fairly sure that I had Katie Lane, who we should absolutely have on the show at some point, yeah. Who is a lawyer to the superstars of cartooning. She's delightful and super intelligent, super willing to share what she knows about the law. And she can probably best handle this kind of question better than we. But even though we're not lawyers, Katie had drawn up a one-page contract that basically said this is work for hire, meaning that the copyright stays with the artist that's doing the hiring, the ownership of stays with the artist doing the hiring, and that the person that's being hired is being brought on to do a very specific subset of tasks for the project and being paid or remunerated in fashion, and that is the extent of the relationship. Isn't that the best way to describe for work for hire, Brad, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
And then the graduating steps are, then there's an employee who is brought in on a full-time basis and in-house. But again, it's still the case where the copyrights and the trademarks and the ownership and control of the property stay with me. But in this case, it's just full-time pay and et cetera, and benefits and all that. If people have a larger company, like I know Penny Arcade has 15 or so people, I'm sure there are health and insurance benefits and all that sort of stuff. What's a different one? And then you graduate up to partnerships, which that's when you start contractually sharing the copyright, the ownership, the control, the profit making, the profit sharing, and the cost sharing. So that's another different thing from a work for hire to partnering, which is that you're not only sharing the control and ownership and profit, you're also controlling and owning and sharing in the costs and in the risk taking. Which is a good way to distinguish. And again, I am not a lawyer. Brad is not a lawyer, but these are our best layman's ways of describing the ways you can structure it. Is there any layering onto that, Brad, that you would like to make?
Yeah, couple things. Number one, Katie Lane, she also does a website called workmadeforhire.net. And that's a place you want to bookmark, because she's always updating her blog with really, really useful information, especially stuff that creators like us, it tends not to be in our wheelhouse. Definitely check that out and do a little reading. She's a very good writer, and she makes a lot of these complicated concepts very easy to digest. So yeah, if you are talking about bringing in like a colorist or somebody that's going to be working on your comic with you, by all means, you need to work under a contract. The whole idea that this is your question is fantastic, because it shows that your head is exactly in the right place. This is the question you need to be asking if you're working with a colorist or anyone that's going to be involved in your creative process. So yeah, You need a contract. You do, even if you're really good friends, even if this person's your brother or like a brother or is your sister or like a sister. In fact, if it's family, you definitely need a contract because there's a lot more at stake if there's a misunderstanding of what the work situation was. And really, this every legal contract, and we get upset because we talk about legalese and we don't understand legalese. There's a reason that contracts are written the way they are, and that is because they're trying to use words that have certain legal meanings that define as closely as possible what everybody's expectations are, because they know that nine chances out of 10, most of the conflict that's going to arise is going to be because there's a misunderstanding of expectations.
That's exactly right, and even aside from the contractual setting of rules and boundaries, which is part of what a contract does, in the worst case scenario, the contract sets out what will happen in the worst case scenario. Somebody wants to sue somebody else. Somebody dies from a project. Somebody rage quits a project. So, all the worst case things that could happen. A contract ideally sets out, here's what steps will be taken in that process. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it from a positive standpoint, and I think this is one of the great things that Katie comes at it from with contract negotiation, is that it also sets up an open and clear conversation before you even start, which is what Brad was just saying. Is that if, like Brad, when Brad and I were starting Comic Lab, for example, and before we even brought in Katie and then continuing on after Katie kindly wrote up a contract for us, Brad and I had a conversation. What are our expectations? What happens if I need to quit? What happens if you need to quit? What happens if we don't make enough money and we have to throw a bunch of costs in? What happens if we do make a lot of money and all of a sudden we're flush with cash? What happens if someone joins us on the show? All these sort of things. And what's great is that no one in a contractual conversation gets surprised.
Right.
Because you're preparing for the worst. But you're also, in an ideal world, you're talking over all the best case scenarios and you're fleshing out the world before it even happens in terms of your working relationship.
I want to go back just for a second to the concept of work made for hire, because especially as artists, we do such a good job of warning our fellow artists against work made for hire contracts, because it's a good way to lose all your rights to the thing that you're working on. That doesn't mean that work made for hire contracts are bad. It just means that you should go in with your eyes open. I've worked under a number of work made for hire contracts, not because I was forced into it, but because it was the best way for that project to move forward. And I made sure that I got paid more up front, because once that project was done, I wasn't going to be able to monetize it any further, because obviously the copyright belonged to the person holding the contract. But also, don't feel bad if you are going to bring in, again, I'm going to talk about a colorist because that's the extent of my knowledge here. When I brought in a colorist at two different times in my career, those people signed contracts that basically said that when they were working on an Evil Inc. Comic, they did not have copyright to that final project. Right, they can't go out and produce a book of Evil Inc. strips, even though they colored them. That falls directly under work made for hire. That final project, they don't have any copyright claim to. It's not a bad thing. It's just a thing, and sometimes it's a thing that you may very well want to be involved in, and in some cases you may want to decide against it. But don't let those idea of a work made for hire contract, don't get knee jerk on that. It's not an automatic bad thing. In some cases, it's there to clarify for everybody involved.
Right, right. And there are a lot of projects, and you can imagine this throughout the industry, there are gradations of involvement and gradations of control. So to continue what Brad was saying with work made for hire not immediately being a bad thing, If there is a project that Brad is working on and he just wants me to come on to design one quick character, let's look at it in the most positive light. It's not my project. It's Brad's project. He's mm-hmm. going to control it, own it, and do it whatever he wants with it. He just needs my help designing a very specific character for which I'm happy to do. And I might not even want any part of the ownership or control. So for that case, I would just say, oh, yeah, Brad, that's great. Let's do a work made for hire. Pay me $200. I'll design that character for you. Bada bing, bada boom. I'm out. And there you go. But if Brad and I for years are working on a graphic novel together, that's where a very different set of conversations has to happen in terms mm-hmm. of partnership. Yeah. Because then we're working on it together. There's a sense of ownership. There's a sense of both wanting to control the path and the direction that that project is going to go. And that is far less of a work made for hire project. In that case, we're going to talk about like, okay, Brad did 80% of the lifting on this, but Dave did 20% too. So maybe I get a say, if not a controlling say, in this project and where it goes.
Yeah.
And then there's true 100% partnerships where two people are absolutely writing a book together. And so much like Brad and I structured Comic Lab, where we both get an equal say on it. And so there's gradations all along the way. And you can imagine a billion different projects that you personally could be involved in that fall into those different gradations. And that's why work made for hire is not necessarily an evil thing. You just have to go in with eyes open and with a very clear understanding, usually through a lawyer, of what contract you're signing. And you'll be okay.
Yeah. Last point, help me out, Dave. Is a threshold $500, I think, if you're paying somebody and you, over the course of a year, pay them more than $500, you have to give them a formal 1099.
You know, it's funny. You should ask that. I thought it was $600.
You might be right. I think they might have raised it because I remember when I was teaching my entrepreneurship class, when I first started teaching, it was $500. And then one of the students actually asked a question. I had to look it up, and I think they bumped it up. But it's either five or six for sure. But once you cross that threshold, you owe that person a 1099 form that says formally I paid this contracted employee for a certain amount of money. That's for everybody's protection. You can take that and deduct it from your taxes. They can show that as income on their taxes. It's just it's good for everybody. But it's just another level of red tape and a little something you've got to check off your list this time of year.
Absolutely, yeah. And it can't be emphasized enough that before you sign anything, make sure you understand what you're signing. But that's true both for the person giving the contract and the person receiving the contract. If you've had a lawyer write it up for you. One of my favorite things about what Katie does is as much as possible, she explains and again, uses a common parlance rather than a legalese to make it approachable for artists to understand and sign their contracts with a good heart. And if your lawyer is not able to do that for you, make sure you go through with them and just understand the different clauses, the different steps that are being taken in the contract. Because it's ultimately, these are the rules that you're going to be playing by for the project, and you want to make sure you understand it.
Oh, yeah. And don't be afraid to pipe up and ask questions in that situation. If you don't understand it, don't sit there and pretend you know you did and hope, you know, you don't want to feel silly or feel stupid, especially for what you pay a lawyer. Get your money's worth. Make them explain every bit of it to you. You know, that's well worth your money.
And if you're an artist in your 20s and you're being approached by, let's just say, a smaller comic book company, of which there is two or three that are not Marvel or DC, just make sure you look at that contract really close because there's some stinker contracts that get sent to 20-year-olds from the, I would say, the three or four smaller comic book companies of which we're all aware. You will laugh at this, Brad. I got involved in a project once with one of those companies.
Really?
And they did not get my sign off at the right time. And so it was off to the presses in China. And they're like, oh, Dave, we need you to sign this contract. And so I literally lined out about 8 clauses in the contract, signed it, and sent it back. And they're like, no, we need you to sign the whole contract. And I said, no, your book is at the presses. I am not signing those clauses. Yeah. I'm signing these clauses.
And good for
eventually,
you.
eventually the president of the company called me and he's like, Dave, I just don't understand what the problem is. What are the problem with these clauses? And I said, you know what? There might've been some misunderstanding because this is a bad contract and I didn't want to sign this one. So I X'd out the 8 clauses that I didn't want to sign. And he's like, all right. And so I signed it with the 8 clauses X'd out. And so I could only do that really because they were already at the press. But if you're in your 20s and 30s, there are I don't want to say predatory, but kind of predatory contracts out there that are very, what's the best way to say it? Unkind to a younger cartoonist. So just be careful.
That's fair to say. They don't have your best interest at heart. They have their best interest at heart. And that's fair, but it's also not a reason to sign a contract. And know that we should do a whole show on contracts. But listen, as long as we're on the topic, you should know when you go in to sign a contract, you don't have to sign that whole contract. Think of what Dave did. He saw clauses he didn't like. He lined them right out. And then the negotiation begins. And I've said this 100 times in 100 different places. If you sit down with somebody who's unwilling to negotiate a contract, run away. Because that's what business is all about. It's all about negotiating. And if you're sitting there with somebody who's not willing to negotiate, you're not sitting with a true business person. Get the hell out of there and thank them for showing you who they were and get out. Because the last thing you need to do is sign a contract because A, you think that it can't be negotiated, or B, you got kind of pushed into it, or C, they pulled this on you. You've heard this, Dave. You've heard this 100 times. Yeah, that's in the contract, but we're never, ever going to do that. That's a boilerplate contract. We get that from legal. They got it. They say it's got to be in there, but you know me. I'm never going to exercise the rights that are in that contract. We're doing this on a handshake. We've been in that chair 100 different times too. And if they're not going to use that, then it doesn't need to be in the contract. Exit out and don't sign it until you do.
Well, and here's the flip side of that too, is that person that you like, that you trust, that editor that's giving you that line in comics, guess what? 6 months from now, they're fired from that company. I guarantee it, because the turnover in comics is atrocious. And
the person that comes in and holds that contract is not beholden to any promises that the person before made.
All of this is wrapped up in the fact that we don't go into comics for the money. I mean, if we wanted to be rich, we would all be bankers. So right. I understand that a lot of these contracts are not, these work for hire contracts that are given to 20 and 30 year olds aren't going to be promising a lot of money, because frankly, there's in some cases, there's not a lot of money to be given. But I take offense when there are clauses that, like, you're willingly giving up your moral rights in Europe and you're giving up your artist rights in the US. And that bothers me. So just go in with eyes wide open and have a lawyer look at it if you're not familiar with the legalities of contract. Because in hiring a lawyer once or twice, you'll also learn and you'll get better at reading the who, what, where's of contracts as you go in your career. So it's one of those hats that you have to slowly start wearing. And hiring a lawyer is one of the first ways to start putting on your own hat.
Absolutely. And on that note, guess what? Guess what?
I we get more Jay Leno? Please say more Jay Leno.
No, I was going to tell you this. You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Oh, well, in that case, your hosts have been Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com, and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
Oh, and in case I didn't tell you, it's also Dave Kellett, and he's the co-director of Stripped and the cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And lest it be forgotten, Brad, the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from the delightful Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net.
Oh, man. Well, then that's only left to say this. Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice. patreon.com/comiclab.